Welcome back to the Lars Restored, still a podcast brought to you by me, Lars Stevenson, in this year of our Lord 2025. That's going to take a while to get used to saying, isn't it? 2025. We are no longer brought to you by Betson. After many, many years now of a very fruitful collaboration between myself and Betson, we have parted ways. And the only thing I have to say about that is that I'm super grateful for all the support I've had from them over the years. They've been just a super supportive and loyal employer for a very, very long time. So I'm just really grateful for all of that. Currently, I'm starting a pretty big new project that's going to take up a lot of my time, but one of those things I can't tell you about just yet. I guess very smart people can take a guess at what kind of thing that is about, but there'll be a time to talk about that. For the podcast, it goes on, I think, for a while, and we'll see what happens with that. I've not made any plans. The main plan right now is to have a chat with our favorite person in the world, in the Lars Resort, I think, Peter Welpton, who's come back. Peter's become this kind of character who's always around when a big change happens in my life, which maybe we should dive into. I haven't told you a lot about my big changes, but there have been some. And Peter's always around, it seems. So I'm always glad to have you. And for our 100th, it's the 100th episode of the Lars Resort, heading into a new calendar year. What better time to have Peter back on the podcast? Welcome, Peter.
Well, hello there, Lars. It's good to speak to you. Happy New Year. Is your new top secret project and change that you have begun to cosplay as your favorite anime character? Is that what it is?
Oh, I don't even have a favorite anime character. I'm not. I'm a very old man, Peter.
You are not a very old man. Stop it. You're offending this very old man.
Okay. No, I think you're more youthful than I am in some ways, which if you look at our birth dates is not great for me. but you know, that's kind of how we are. You're much more into the youth culture. Favorite anime character? What's that? I don't have that. There's some things. I will talk about stuff when I can talk about stuff, but you know, there'll be a time for that. Instead,
I'm going to help the pod listener enjoy this by just making random guesses out of the blue. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. That's all fine. Right. But I think my idea for how to keep doing the pod for now is basically I want to hang out with Peter on a regular basis, and we might as well record what comes out of our mouths when that occurs. And I have this notion that we should meet up maybe weekly, see what we can do with our schedules, and just go pick a couple of things from the weekend that was interesting. And just pick like three things and just crack on with it. I have in no way stolen this format from On the Continent, even though it is exactly the same format. So really just a tip of the hat to the guys at Stakhanov and the Football Ramble guys who...
They copied it from somebody else for sure.
I'm sure they did. I'm sure that this is exactly the same idea. But let's have three subjects that we crack on to. And we're not going to do Game of the Week because I always forget to do that anyway when I'm doing On the Continent. But the first subject, with a tip of the hat to Peter Welpton as well, is your favorite club, Manchester United, had kind of a good day at the office this weekend. After many bad days at the office, how do you feel?
Let me say this. If I would assume neutrals... If I enjoyed this game and thought it was a proper entertaining football match, I would assume the neutrals were over the moon by this. Obviously, as a United fan, this was unexpected. I went into this game thinking this was going to be another one of these very trendy Liverpool blowouts of United, but it didn't turn out that way. I'm really interested in that post-game reaction from MRM and Bruno Fernandes, who almost seemed defiantly angry, like, hey, wait a second, where did this come from? Like, just a few days ago, we were utter shit, and now today, against the best club on and a place that we really struggle at, we were really, really good. Where has this been? And I do find that interesting, along with the idea and the message from MRM that, hey, look, I got to do two proper training sessions. And is this some sort of indicator that there is some hope on the horizon for this club? That if once he gets his chance to really do his thing with this group of guys, it's not a roster of 26 knuckleheads that can't play the game at all. He can actually turn them into something useful.
But I've never really thought they were a roster of knuckleheads. Was it we? I forget. I think we had a chat on this pod.
Did you see the Newcastle game, Lars?
Yeah, I did. But that's, you had the Geriatricos back in midfield, which is not a good idea.
Right.
Like, yeah,
right.
Old man, right. Eriksen and thick boy Casemiro versus that Newcastle midfield is not a matchup that you ever want to see. Yeah, but did we not have this conversation? We went through the United team and watched, like, who of these would work, make sense in a 3-4-3? And actually, the number is more than you might think. I think there is the beginnings of a team that would make sense in Amorim's system here, but they need time to work on it. And I think I saw someone tweet that it was like a bad day for everyone who said that Amorim should have changed his formation, which I was like, huh, you mean he's unlost all of those games that you lost over the holidays? Like, that those bad results were still bad. It's still possible that he should have gone in and maybe less. We haven't said, guys, we have no time on the training ground. Let's just do something you guys are vaguely familiar with for the next month or so. And then when we have time to work on it, we'll start doing my thing. It's possible that that would have still been the better move. Nevertheless, in this game, I thought in the first half, when United were maybe not great, but I thought they looked notably less confused, if that makes sense. I thought there were just general indications that people knew where to stand and where to run and this sort of stuff. Am I wrong?
No, I thought defensively in particular, it was very clear that Emerson had made some tactical adjustments to his system specifically for this game. He had stacked him up in kind of a 5-4-1 that really stymied Liverpool for long stretches of the game. That was a bit of a different look. Clearly having Ugarte and Maynou in the middle was a huge difference from the Newcastle game, as you mentioned, because you got guys that can actually cover space and run. And
yeah.
Ugarte is just an absolute pit bull of a human being, by the way.
yeah.
And while there were still moments defensively where a couple of people were allowing Liverpool midfielders to run into the box unmarked or turning off or ball watching here and there, it was better. What I was concerned about, at least earlier in the game, was once United gets the ball, especially not in transition moments, they still look very confused as to what the system is supposed to be like when they have it and are trying to score. But hey, it worked out.
Yeah, I did think there were some, maybe I'm being too happy, maybe I've been Man United pilled here, but I did think there were some nice little combination play down the flanks that they set up, which is one of the benefits of the sort of 3-4-3 formation. You sometimes end up with like an overload in the wide areas and you can kind of make chances that way. I guess it bears saying that the game does kind of turn on a Lisandro Martinez, like smashing one into the roof of the net from a tight angle, which is not a high percentage play. I think that's not something that's going to happen in every game. But I thought there were positives for sure. Ahmad was running around and looking again like a very exciting guy. I thought Bruno was good in this game. I know we're not
Bruno
the most
had an
like,
amazing game.
Between the two of us, we're not the most Bruno positive people in the world, but I thought this was one when he really took a lot of responsibility and showed some experience. There were a lot of moments when he took the ball under pressure and instead of losing it, held on to it a little bit and brought someone into play. And really, I've criticized him a lot. I don't think he's a natural captain for so many reasons, but I thought that was a proper sort of captain's performance by Bruno, which is important in terms of getting this team to work, because however you feel about it, Peter Welpton, I think Bruno's not going anywhere. He signed a big new contract. I don't see where he would go. So you're going to build a team around him going forward, I think, whatever you feel about it.
100% agree on Bruno. I really think if there's something to focus on this game for that is that applies to both Liverpool and United is this whole thing going on that everybody's talking about with Trent and how they really focused on picking on Trent.
Yeah.
You know, they moved Bruno out that way. Onana was knocking the ball out that way. He and Dallo both were really going after it and going after Trent specifically. And clearly Trent did not have a good game. Now, whether it's just coincidence or actually related that his poor performance and picking on him is somehow connected to a distraction with the transfer stuff, I don't know. I'll let other people talk about that. But I was encouraged that Amorim figured an opportunity out and they capitalized on it and actually made hay with it. And the moment you talk about with Martinez and crushing that roof, you know, roofing that goal. If you go back and really look at that, there's a lot of Trent walking about and not covering anybody, just kind of ball watching in that moment. That all kind of starts with them pinging the ball about deep in the Liverpool half to start it. So
Yeah. I mean, I think Amorim mentioned this post-game is that he's kind of been accused of like being too stubborn tactically, but he says, I do make little changes from game to game. It's just the structure of the basic structure of the team is the same, which is true. I think we make that mistake, we in the media, is that we look at the team and if it's in the same formation as usual, we assume no tactical changes have taken place. But of course, that's not quite how it works. The coaches do talk to the players about what they're supposed to do out there and which spaces to attack and who to press when and all this sort of stuff. So there will be changes. And one of the changes that was here, and I should credit Simon Burnton and The Guardian for pointing this out, is that across the season, just 26% of Andre Onana's passes from open play were sent long. But in this game, it was 80%. Like 80% of his balls were launched. Like that's not coincidental that you go from one out of four balls being launched to 8 out of 10. That's clearly an instruction. And as you pointed out, a lot of them were sent in the general direction of Trent Alexander-Arnold, who had a really bad time. Part of me just tends to think this is the downside of Trent Alexander-Arnold as a player. He's a phenomenal attacking force from right back. He has a great delivery. He can come forward and play great passes, but he is iffy defensively, one-on-one. He does tend to switch off sometimes and not properly pay attention. And I would argue that it's always been that way. And I would argue that it was that way when Liverpool racked up, you know, record numbers of points in the Premier League over two seasons under Klopp. It's just that they were better at compensating for it than they have been at times. It's just that that was when they had the boring water carrier midfield that no one wanted. And they were like, we need more creativity. But part of the reason you had all the water carriers is that they needed to cover for the fullbacks who were like crazy, crazy attacking. And I think another thing in here is that as much as Mo Salah is, you could argue that he's the best player in the world right now. He's been amazing. He's having a huge, huge season. Not doing a lot of defensive work at the moment is Mo.
Right.
So when teams are able to attack down that side, you know, he's not getting as much protection from midfield as he used to. He's not getting any protection from Salah, really. And he is a guy who's just not a great defensive fullback. And I think, you know, there's so much talk about him being retrained as a midfielder. I just think that's a whole, like, it's not the first time in the history of world football that you've had a fullback who's been great going forward, but not as great defending. And I think the logical thing to do is build a system around him that protects him a little bit. But I think that you're right in that there's a subtext here of Real Madrid having put in a bid for him, whether that was a serious bid or just to mess with his head or just a symbolic bid to sort of offer Liverpool the opportunity to get some money for him rather than him going there free in the summer. Whatever the case may be, that may have been a slightly destabilizing factor. And it does seem to be that he's increasingly unpopular with the Liverpool fans and possibly even with his own teammates. I thought Van Dijk looked very angry at him a few times, for instance, in this game. And maybe there's the case with having previously set up the system to protect him. Maybe there's the case, well, you, if you feel like you're too good for this club, you want to move on, you can't be at Liverpool, you have to go to Real Madrid, maybe look after yourself a little bit then. Like, we're going to be, I don't know if that's how it works, but it is a strange dynamic to have in the back of everything.
Yeah, the radio show host, my radio show co-host, Andy, is a Liverpool fan, has been forever, and he's really worried about them selling off Trent in the middle of the season, because he thinks that really destabilizes the team. I'm not so sure that's the case. And Van Dijk's reaction to some of the mistakes that Trent was making in the game yesterday, specifically Trent's inability, like Dalot is not a winger or a wingback. And the fact that Diego Dalot was beating him down the line several times and getting crosses into the box was clearly irritating Van Dijk. And once he finally got subbed, what's the very first thing Bradley did? He blocked a cross into the box.
Yeah.
And that was a big difference. And so I think that's a storyline to keep an eye on with Liverpool moving forward. And I also thought it was interesting that Slot didn't seem to make any adjustments to help Trent out. Mm. Now, I'm not saying he hung him out to dry on purpose or was trying to make a point or the system is what it is and we're just going to stick with it. But again, I thought there was some, if you're a United fan, I felt good that Amorim identified a weakness with Liverpool and attacked it. I was a bit surprised Slot didn't, at least until he made the substitution way late in the game, didn't really seem to account for it.
Yeah, I tend to think they won't sell in January just because, you know, for so many years now, it's almost been impossible to win the Premier League because every year City puts up a number that's just not normal and not something a normal team can do, with one exception, of course, being when Liverpool managed it. But generally speaking, it's been a case of, we just have to wait until City have a normal season, a season in which they don't go over 95 points, because no one can live with right. that. Now this season is here for a number of reasons, and you're in the driving seat. That is not the time to cash in on one of your players for like a fairly measly 20 million. You could argue that 20 million is a lot of money for 6 months of a full fullback who can't defend when you have Connor Bradley in the background anyway. But I just think it's not enough money to be worth destabilizing the team when you have a pretty clear run at the title, given the trouble that the rivals are having. Like, this is the time to just not mess about with anything and just keep this going and get this title.
But doesn't it also come with the kind of the oddly destabilizing reality that if maybe Trent wants to go and he doesn't get the deal he wants, now suddenly he's pouty about that, and that affects his game too? I don't know. And that's the kind of quandary I get into in these situations with players.
Yeah, except there's no reason for him to do that because he'll just go in the summer. It just means right. you have to stay yeah. at your boyhood. You just have to stick around and win a league title with your boyhood club for a few months, right. and then you get yeah. to go to Real Madrid. So I think if he was on a long-term contract and they were really pushing to sign him in January, maybe there'd be a risk of this kind of pout. But it's just a case of he'll go in the summer anyway, if that is the case.
It was a great game, Lars. I even if United had lost that game, I thought it was endlessly entertaining. I know everybody loves to poke on Maguire for skying that shot. Xerxes yeah. was offside, and I still think it's better. It was better that he skied it than having to go back and tell him his winner was disallowed. So
that's
I think
probably
that worked out
right,
in favor
actually.
For everybody. Yeah,
that's. I haven't heard anyone point that out, but you're right. It was offside. And it would actually have been worse because he would have had that sort of brief second of celebrating and everyone going wild. And then all cameras exactly. point to him as he looks sad. That's kind of almost more tragic than missing what was actually kind of a difficult ball from Xerxes. It was kind of bouncing, and he's maybe not a natural finisher, is Harry Maguire. So
Harry has a face that when he is despondent and unhappy, could you imagine the sad little boy face you would have gotten out of Harry Maguire if you had told him his yeah. winner at Anfield had been disallowed?
How do you feel about his contract being extended as a Man United fan?
I'm fine with it. I think Maguire is a better center back than a lot of people let on. I think he does a lot of things very well, and I think he can be a useful tool in this system with the right yeah. pairing of two other people. I'm really excited about Lenny Yoro. I thought that tackle he put
yeah.
on
yeah,
he put
so
in
good.
Late in the game was so good. That kid appears to have a lot of upside, and I'm excited to see more yeah. out of him.
No, I think the comparison you could make from your club to the one I support is how Eric Dier had a mini renaissance when Mourinho and Conte came in, and when Conte in particular they started playing with three at the back, because he's not a terrible player, but he was just kind of slow and easy to exploit and isolate. But the second you put someone like him who has a lot of quality or has certain qualities and you kind of protect him with two more mobile center halves either side of him, he was a useful player. And I tend to think the same will be the case for Van Dijk, for Harry Maguire.
Yeah, the other thing to keep an eye on with Liverpool in terms of, you know, the distance that they've gathered in the table and the position and kind of this foreboding sense that they've kind of locked it up is just this now, I think, is the second time two teams have come in and played five in the back against them and given them some trouble. The Nottingham Forest game is the other one that comes to mind. And it just makes me wonder if this is the beginnings of a recipe that Slot's going to have to deal with more often than not.
Yeah, I think that's a good shout, and I think that's an interesting shout. I guess we're not going to... That is not going to be the second subject. We're going to save nope. our Arsenal bashing for a different episode as well, but it's a big point here is that the rivals aren't really pulling up any trees at the moment, so that is kind of helpful for Liverpool, is that their rivals aren't looking very good. The second subject...
Hold on, before you move on to the side, I just want to say one other thing. United play Arsenal in the FA Cup midweek, and then they've got Southampton at home on the weekend.
Yeah.
We're going to learn a lot about this club in the course of the next 7 days.
Who knows who will be in charge of Southampton at the time? Because the Ivan Juric experiment is so far not bearing fruit.
It's like, they wouldn't Ivan Juric after three games, would they?
I mean, why not? Like, he's been brought in to make them more solid, and they just lost 0-5 at home to Brentford. Like, whatever he's trying to do, it's clearly not having the impact that they were looking for.
Russell Martin is available and on the market. He plays.
Yeah, get him back. Yeah, Nathan Jones. Right. What's he up to? Bring him back. I suppose there's no point sacking him. They're getting relegated no matter what. They might as well not spend any more money on firing managers as they go.
I digress. Go back to topic number two.
If we're going to stick to this format, which is in no way stolen from a different podcast that I'm on sometimes, we need to skip to the second segment, which I have decided will be Tottenham, because I think we are at an interesting point with the Ange ball. Sorry?
We're such homers. We've done a United segment, and now we're doing a Spurs segment.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of the first episode in a brave new world for the Last Resort. Why not start with your team and my
team?
What's comfortable?
Why not? Right.
Yeah, let's keep it very comfortable. And this is not comfortable for me, obviously, because it's not good news at Tottenham. And I did think, in the sort of post-match interviews, when Ange kind of was ranting a little bit about, he's kind of backed himself into a corner there, because he did make a big deal about how he'll never criticize the referees. And then he was like, I really want to criticize the referee. And he kept just saying something about how we would have won if the playing field was fair and balanced or something, which is nonsense, obviously, because as much as you may think it was a handball for the first goal, that was very early in the game. And there were a few other incidents in that game that definitely went Tottenham's way. The Kulusevski barge on Anthony Gordon could have very easily been a penalty. There was one thing that I picked up, which no one's really talked about, but Solanke need Dubravka in the face at one point, which is one of those things. It's completely accidental, but his foot was very high. And like, if you end up kneeing an opponent in the face, there's a lot of refs that's going to pull out a red card for that. And I don't think... I'm going to have to edit.
Apparently you can't
say the word.
Oh, you did. What is going on?
I can bleep it out, though. It's fine. Yeah, we're not changing the rules. There might be change afoot at the resort, but that rule is staying. But I'll bleep it out. My point being, I think coming out of that, I think there wasn't enough bad refereeing in that game to justify him breaking his entire stance of not criticizing referees. And that's the first moment I thought with this whole thing, is that he might be starting to lose it a little bit and feeling the pressure, because I don't think it's terrible to, like, they're playing an in-form Newcastle. Everyone's hurt, and the ones that aren't hurt are tired or ill, as the case may be. There was illness in the camp as well. And you end up playing 45 minutes with a back four of Pedro Porro, and then Jed Spence and Archie Gray at center half, and then Reguilón, who is somehow still around, at left back.
I couldn't believe Reguilón made an appearance. I thought he had fallen into soccer's version of the Phantom Zone.
He was hyped. He was ready. He was doing a lot of G-ing up the crowds. He was running around like he was keen to remind the world that he got to play soccer for the first time. Yeah, he was there to remind the world, I exist. Sergio Reguilón is still a thing. Now, I don't think anyone would expect you to get a result under those circumstances. And I honestly think the performance they put in, there was an element of Newcastle taking their foot off the gas, but I thought the second half performance was actually pretty promising. And Ange did go on to say that, but he seems like he's under pressure a little bit now and feeling it and starting to, crack up is a bit strong, but he is, last time I checked, he was second in the sack race with the bookmakers.
Is he? I wondered about this.
Yeah. Yeah. So he's not, because, and I think the big reason for that is that, you know, it's January, where you are in the table doesn't matter a ton yet, I would argue, but the gap between you and where you want to be is starting to matter a lot. And right, Spurs are 12th. And that's not, if you were 12th, but there were 5 points between you and sixth or something, that'd be fine. But they're 12th on 24 points, and fifth, which has to be the target now, is 35. So you're 9 points behind what is really the sort of the aim for the season. And that's not a small gap, really. And you're on a bad run as well. So I think when Champions League is no longer feasible, when you get a sense that this is a failed season, the project is not working, that is historically when Daniel Levy's sacking foot starts getting a little bit twitchy. So I really think a lot of it will come down to the cups at this point. I think that's where they can kind of rescue something, perhaps, this season, Tottenham.
So my question for you is what I've been wondering, which is, now we're into a second season of Postecoglou filled with injury. And I'm wondering if you as a fan are chalking that up to A, just crappy luck on the injury bug front, or B, Are you starting to wonder if any of this has something to do with Postecoglou, his staff, or how they go about, you know, managing this team?
Yeah, I should just briefly correct myself. They're not 9 points behind fifth. They're 11 points behind fifth because I can't do maths too good. So actually, my point is, gap big, coach in trouble. It's a pertinent question that you ask, Peter, because it's something that's been on my mind. And listen, when we talk about football, inevitably we end up talking about things that we don't know a lot about, and we try to form sort of half-assed opinions. And I try to, like, when we come onto subjects where I'm totally unqualified to have an opinion, I try to not have an opinion. And I have to say, when the matter of physical fitness would be one of those areas, I don't know enough about, like, maybe we should try to bring a fitness coach on the pod to talk about this at one point. I just think, just logically, if you are the head coach of a football team, I feel like the physical state of your players and their readiness to do their jobs is part of your remit. Now, if this was a squad full of old guys and dudes with terrible injury records that the club had brought together, then maybe it's not the coach's fault that they keep getting hurt. But that's not the case. It's a pretty young squad of pretty athletic guys. And when they keep picking up that many injuries, I kind of feel like there has to be a link between the workload that they're being put under and the fact that they're getting so many injuries. But again, I am way out of my comfort zone knowledge-wise on this one. It just, and I'm still, this is a small thing, right? And I should research this more. Have we heard the Mickey van de Ven? Do you remember at the Chelsea game when Romero and van de Ven were rushed back from injury to play against Chelsea because Ange was a little bit desperate for a result? Both of them came off. Mm-hmm. Romero with a fresh injury, different injury. Whereas van de Ven, when he walked up, he looked sad. He looked upset when he was subbed. He looked to me like a guy who had re-injured himself. But in the post-match press conference, Postecoglou said, no, we were always planning to take him off. But he hasn't played since. So I think he did re-injure himself. And I think Postecoglou was not being entirely honest about what happened there, is my theory. Anyway, that's just a small thing that's neither here nor there. But, so, but the point you started at before I started talking for like 5 minutes simultaneously, consecutively, I don't know is the short answer, but I think it's a question you have to start asking to people who know more about it than I do.
So here we are, kind of midway point of the season. Tottenham is in 12th on 24 points, and United is in 13th with a point behind them. Lars, which one are you feeling better about right now in terms of how this season will end?
Ooh, interesting question. Let's make it even more concise. Which of these has a better chance of getting a Champions League spot? Let's put it that way.
Oh, I think neither one of them. But
who has the who has the best chance at a Champions League spot, at making fifth at the end of the season? Because I don't think the chance is zero for either of them. It's not great, but it's not zero.
I think there are five better teams than both of these.
Season. Yeah. But they might turn out to be bad. They might have bad. Yeah, actually, I want to turn around. I'm actually just going to give myself some time to find the betting odds. What do you think, Peter, out of those two?
Well, that's why I think this is an interesting question, because Postecoglou is an established manager in his second season. MRM has just stepped into this messy house, and he's trying to put everything in order. So you would think that it would be Spurs are going to end up having the better final position in the table at the end of the season. But I think we know enough about how Postecoglou is stubborn-headed about his system and his struggles to get it to be consistent that there's a part of me that thinks MRM is going to have more success instituting his system over the long term of the rest of the season than Postecoglou getting everybody healthy and playing correctly. I don't think they'll be that far apart by the end of the season, but it would not surprise me to see United ahead of Spurs by the time we get to the end of the 24-25 calendar.
Yeah, so this is annoying. Since we're no longer sponsored by a betting company, we might not be doing betting segments anymore. But I've stumbled upon two kind of interesting bets there, I think. Because I was just checking bets on our Daily Departed, but still very good friends. Not Daily Departed, that implies that they're dead. They're definitely not that. But our good friends at Betson, they're still good friends. They don't offer prices for who will finish top five, which is kind of annoying because that's super pertinent since that's the Champions League spot. But they do offer prices on which team will finish top six. And I don't know, what do you think, Peter? Who do you think is the shortest and longest odds out of Tottenham and United to finish sixth?
I'm going to say the longest odds right now are United, Tottenham, the shortest odds.
Yeah, you're right about that. And it's actually pretty big. Spurs are at 10 to finish in the top six, and United are at 17 to finish in the top six. I kind of think both of those are interesting outside shots, because I think if Tottenham can get their players healthy again, I think they'll go back to being kind of good. And I think there's a few teams above them in the table that have the potential to drop off for various reasons. Whereas United, they're a work in progress. I'm not expecting big things from them, but they do have good. I maintain they're not all dunces in that squad. So if Amorim can do some work with them, it's completely impossible that they go on a run between now and the end of the season. Is this too much recency bias for me, having watched them be not ridiculous against Liverpool? What do you think?
That's kind of what I'm saying, Lars, is that I again, this may be recency bias between the last two games, but there is a sense I have that the chances of Amorim putting something a better run together than Postecoglou, at least in this moment, is I would favor United in that.
Yeah. No, I guess, yeah, we may have veered off track for this segment a tiny bit, but I just tended to, I guess the point I wanted to make is that I am starting to get to the point where I don't think the Postecoglou project, in inverted commas, is recoverable. I think we're starting, and you can say that the injuries are not his fault and it's been difficult for him, but at the same time, for me, it's his inability to adapt to circumstances, which makes me think this is probably not going to work out long term. Mm-hmm. If you're Tottenham, you're the sort of fifth, sixth wealthiest team in the league, and you're trying to get into the top four regularly, you're going to have to outsmart the opponent a little bit, and you're going to have to find ways of beating teams that can spend more money than you. And I'm not sure that is a position for someone who's like totally dogmatic about how he wants things to be done at all times. And I'm also not sure the Postecoglou system, it seems to require everyone to be fully fit and to be playing near the maximum capacity for it to work well. And that's just not going to be the case every week over a full season. And I just think his inflexibility makes me think this is probably not going to work out. And the fact that there's such a big gap makes me think his position is under a lot of threat. So it is the League Cup semi-final against Liverpool. Try to get something out of that. And I do actually think the Europa League is a weirdly important tournament for Tottenham now, because that could be like a sneaky back route into the, there is a Champions League spot to be had in the Europa League. Sure. And I think they're now more likely to get that one by winning that tournament than they are to get it through the league. I can tell you that by looking at the odds right now, they're at 5 to win the Europa League. They are current favorites to win the Europa League. But I guess the idea is that this injury crisis will fade, hopefully. At that point, they'll be in such a bad shape in the league that they will and should prioritize the Europa League over the league fixtures, not the other way around, which is what we're used to seeing. And maybe that could be a way to get this back on track. But I increasingly think this might be done. I think that the Ange ball might be coming to an end, which would be sad because I have enjoyed having a coach who I kind of find likable as a person, not hugely objectionable, as was the case with the last couple of guys, Mourinho and Conte anyway. We'll take Nuno out of the conversation here. Since you have touched on this stuff with league places and I touched on it a little bit.
Hold on. My question is, imagine the crisis klaxons that take place if Liverpool goes back-to-back drawing at home against United and losing in a cup tournament to Spurs.
I think, well, first of all, it's two-legged, so that's just the first leg.
Second of all, I think
if you're the runaway leaders of the Premier League, nothing that happens in the League Cup can trigger a crisis klaxon.
But
that tournament becomes it's the room of requirement from Harry Potter, The tournament is what you need it to be. if you're stinking out the place in the league and you need some kind of cup run to save your season, boom, League Cup. And if you go out, it doesn't matter because it's just a League Cup anyway. Whereas, of course, yeah, no, if you're doing well in the league, if you win in the League Cup, that's great. It shows winning mentality. If you don't win, it doesn't matter. You can focus on the league. So it's a great tournament because it kind of, you can decide if it matters or not. It's entirely up to you in the circumstances. So that's
all right.
Yeah. So this is, I can't believe it's number three. I can't believe it's me trying to keep the running time down and not you. This is a complete reversal of how these things usually go. Topic number three is the one you picked. I picked two and let you pick one. That's not very democratic. Well, maybe we should, you know, change that. But
no, it's fine. I like
I let you have a third pick for this one.
All right. So mine is, and I'm interested in your perspective in a typical Premier League season. When you get to the new year, how often do you look at the table and go, "Oh yeah, that's totally not real. This is going to be completely different by the time we get to May." If you look at it this season, do you have a different perspective on it?
I would say two things. I would say, and that's kind of repeating something I said earlier, which is I don't really care about the order of the teams in the table so much as the gaps between the various teams and where they want to be. I think that's the thing that matters this time of year. Like if Spurs were 12th but had like 4 or 5 points up to 6th and 5th, that wouldn't matter. But when it's 11, it does. And the other thing I would look at, and listeners, you can probably imagine, maybe even say it together with me on the count of three, 1, 2, 3, I look at the XG. I look at the XG to see if there's any teams that are just kind of dramatically out of sync with where their numbers are. And if they're overperforming by a ton or underperforming by a ton, I would kind of expect some kind of regression on that between now and the end of the season.
Well, we are at a point where Forest is third, Bournemouth is seventh, Fulham has drawn a lot lately and kind of fallen off a bit, as has Brighton. But in a new world where PSR and teams aren't going to be able to buy their way back to dominance in the way that they've traditionally been able to do it, I am going to be interested to watch if a Forest and a Bournemouth, or a Fulham for that matter, are capable of continuing to power and push people for these European spots as the season goes on. That's what feels different to me now, is that everybody seems hypersensitive about their ability to spend. Because, you know, historically, well, I'll look at this and go, oh, City will just go out and spend a bunch of money to make up for their gaps. United will just buy their way back up the table. And we know that at least that this is what we're being told, they can't do that anymore. So I just wonder, as we look at the table, how real is what we're seeing at the beginning of 25 and how that will look when we get to May?
Okay, so I will then... Yeah, I will then default back. As I said, I would tend to look at the XG as something that can be a more accurate reflection of performance than points.
So, if you look at XG, where how does that apply to the table today? Is there a team that is up at the top of the table that is vastly outperforming themselves?
We'll get to that, but you know what? There is one thing. Yeah, there is that, but there is another thing that, again, might blow your mind a bit, though it might not, because I think I mentioned it before. Bournemouth actually have the third best XG difference in the league. So you look at Bournemouth and you say, wow, they're having a good season. They're all the way up in seventh. Actually, on the XG, they're third. So they're having an even better season than what they've gotten back in terms of results. Bournemouth are in Bournemouth, and that just at least tells me that Bournemouth being top half is 100% like a real thing. They are definitely one of the better teams in the season, and the XG has them being even better. So even again, we're maybe not doing a betting segment anymore, but if I was, I'd be backing a lot of Bournemouth in the sort of weeks and months going forward, unless they have injuries, unless they lose guys in January. But Bournemouth, having a good season, underlying numbers, the XG suggests they're actually even better than that. Conversely, Nottingham Forest's numbers are fine, but they're not third place fine. They're
interesting.
4, 5, 6, 7. They're down in eighth on the XG, which is a great place for Nottingham Forest to be, with the perspective of like the first the start of the season. Have the eighth best XG in January in the league, they would absolutely have taken that. That's a fabulous stuff for Nottingham Forest. But it does suggest that there's a chance their performance could drop off a little bit unless they start playing better. So the sort of variance in finishing and stuff like that is probably going to turn on them a little bit. Does that correspond with your thoughts about who's like higher than you think they should be and vice versa?
Yeah, I think so. I think Bournemouth is an incredibly impressive performance so far, considering when they sold Solanke, I thought, okay, that's really going to mess up their season because I don't think they've got a really good replacement for it. But that's obviously worked out for them. Forrest is the one that completely has caught me by surprise. I, like many people, had him down for relegation. I do think it's the Nuno revenge tour. If anybody has come out from the first half of the season smelling like a rose, it's that guy. Maybe the numbers will come true and Forrest will settle out here quickly and maybe Bournemouth raises up. And I think we all had a Liverpool, Arsenal, a Chelsea, maybe a Newcastle, maybe an Aston Villa, or even a Spurs to end up in the top five spots. And maybe that's how it plays out that way. But it will not surprise me to see a Forrest or a Bournemouth figure out how to end up in one of those five spots by the end of this.
I guess it. Team to flag up, since I have the XG difference, and I'm looking at fbref.com for my numbers, as I usually do. They get their numbers from Opta, who I think are very credible sort of data providers. Interesting. I mean, they've been on a great run of form recently, so it's maybe not a huge surprise, but given how poor they were earlier in the season, Newcastle have got the fourth best XG difference in the league now.
Yeah.
Might that be midfield, for real. Newcastle.
That move of Tonali into the middle of the field has paid dividends. Guimaraes, Joelinton, and Tonali in a midfield is really good looking stuff.
Yeah, and they seem to have just kind of found the right mix between the three of them as well. Who does what? And because I think in terms of their instincts for how they want to play the game, I suspect Tonali and Guimaraes, their natural thing is to do a lot of the same stuff on the field in terms of the positions they take up, but they seem to have found a balance there. And I don't know if you felt sorry for, I know it doesn't feel like natural to feel sorry for Man United in any situation, but when the great Manchester United at home at Old Trafford take on Newcastle, like again, with Christian Eriksen and Casemiro in midfield against the sort of Bruno Tonali and Joelinton midfield, I mean, they were outmatched in the middle in that. And it's a really nicely, like if Bruno and Tonali can sort of figure out the division of tasks between them, then you've got Joelinton, who provides just a ton of physical capacity next to that. That is one of the better midfields in the league, I think. That's not too hyperbolic. Maybe not the best, as I saw one Newcastle correspondent suggests, but it's certainly one of the better midfield units in the league. And it's Eddie Howe continues to be a strange old manager, because he's clearly quite good at his job, but his teams are always, this goes back to the Bournemouth time, his teams are always been quite streaky. Now, I wonder what the reason for this is. Like, Bournemouth would do this as well. They would have months when they were doing really well and people would go, "Oh, Eddie Howe, he is a former future England boss, he is the best," and then they would just kind of lose a bunch of games and no one would talk about it because they're Bournemouth, so no one cares. At Newcastle, it's slightly different. When Newcastle now lose a bunch of games, people do care and it becomes a story and it's like, Eddie Howe, has he lost it, whatever. But they seem to, having had that kind of iffy run in the autumn, seemed to have just kind of snapped out of it and started winning again. Maybe that's just how sports work, but it seems to be a particular sort of Eddie Howe thing of his teams being streaky.
I do have this weird sense that has popped into my head that every time we all think Eddie Howe's about to get the sack at Newcastle, they go on this amazing run of form and they start playing really well. And that's where they're at this particular moment.
And conversely, it was the same, but the opposite with Bournemouth. Anytime we started talking, wow, they're doing so well, he must be the next England manager or get the United job or something, they would just lose a bunch of games. So it seems to be an Eddie Howe thing. But I guess the what I want to end it on is that, yeah, Newcastle, not in fifth by accident. They're the fourth best XG in the league. Down at the bottom, it's just kind of what you would expect. And that's actually kind of interesting. The Leicester, Ipswich and Southampton have got the three worst sets of XG numbers in the league, with Wolves the one most closest to them, but it's not close. I mean, Leicester, Ipswich and Southampton have on the XG bin, like, clearly identifiably the three worst teams in the league, and then there's a small gap up to Wolves and a small gap up to Everton, and then a gap up to West Ham. So it is those three are the worst three teams in the league, and Wolves and Everton are the ones who could be in trouble if one of the bottom three were to improve.
By the way, just so everybody knows, Eddie Howe's run for the rest of January is home to Wolves, home to Bournemouth, away at Southampton.
Yeah. And I guess, I double-checked the actual points now. And Ipswich, I mean, they've got 16 points now. So that's kind of interesting. Their numbers are kind of stinky. And I do wonder if Ipswich are one of those teams. I think I mentioned it on the big XG episode we had a couple of months back, that Ipswich have had a few games where they've gotten spanked, but they've had been pretty competitive in the few of the other ones. So maybe that's something the numbers are kind of hiding. But I picked Ipswich, Leicester, and Southampton to go down, and I'm feeling pretty confident about that still. Very confident about Southampton going down. I mean, that's right. Not going well for them at all.
So to end this particular segment, because I'm a big believer in beginning, middle, and end, do you, Lars, look at the table this year differently at the halfway point than you normally would and think, yeah, this is not realistic. It'll look very different by the end of the year.
I'm almost certain there have been seasons where there have been more teams that have been out of position, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. There's usually more. I seem to feel like there's usually more that you look at and say that position, the underlying numbers don't back that up. You could, if you want to be very generous, you could say that with Tottenham, it's all because of injuries. So when the people that are injured come back, they'll be good again. I mean, that's a very sort of Ange positive approach that you can take to this. But there's only really there's only a couple of teams that are way out where the numbers suggest that they should be, and it's kind of Bournemouth, who should be even higher, which is not what you expected to say, and Nottingham Forest, who are a little bit higher. Actually, Brighton are a little bit, they're unusually for Brighton, they're a bit further down than a bit further up than the numbers suggest they should be. Mm-hmm. I do start to wonder. Anyway, I feel like we've reached a good sort of end point to the episode. Not going to start on a whole Brighton thing now. Do you have anything additionally to add, Peter?
No, the one thing I want to keep an eye on is the idea that when you look at the schedule and the rest of the season and Arsenal chasing Liverpool, is the fact that Arsenal has played all of the big teams away and Liverpool has played most of the big teams at home. And so now they get the inverse of that advantage or disadvantage for the rest of the season, and whether or not that's going to play a part in one catching up or pulling away from the other is an interesting side note to me.
Yeah. Arsenal, I don't usually, I tend to think making a lot of signings in January is a sign of sickness at a club and not something you want to see really as a fan. Right. If your club is doing a lot of business in January, that's a sign they don't have their act together. Arsenal, I think, is a rare case of a club that actually go into January and really need to do something. Because they're not out of this, you know. Yeah, the gap is 6 points, and with the game in hand being probably the Merseyside derby, the game in hand being that it's probably 9. But you know, they're not fully out of this title race, Arsenal. But we have that over reliance on Saka that we've seen for a long time is still an issue, and now with Saka out, there's not enough like production from Martinelli, from Trossard, from Gabriel Jesus, from Havertz, all the guys. So I think they could really do with going into, if they have any wiggle room with regards to PSR, and if the Kroenkes are willing to release some funds, they could really do with adding a productive sort of wide forward type of player, or even a striker if you want to go in this direction, but some sort of attacking players who can give them a little bit more. And it's not a huge swing for them to be right back in the title race here, but I think they do need to add something.
Well, as maybe differently everybody feels about the holiday schedule for both those teams, I believe if my math is correct, Liverpool were 9 points ahead when it started, and they're effectively 9 points ahead after the cluster of games. The real loser out of that whole deal is Chelsea. Chelsea dropping all those points over the last four games they were the ones that really fell off the pace over the holiday crunch.
Yeah. So let's have a Chelsea segment soon. We can explore that. But for now,
I don't know.
Okay. Let's not have a segment on it then. I have thoughts, as is often the case. No betting segment at the end, because we're currently like seeking representation, I guess. So that's not happening. But maybe we'll again in the future. Who knows? I quite enjoy it.
Maybe a listener wants to sponsor the pod, Lars. Maybe they have a business. They would like to become the sponsor of the Lars Resort.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there's all kinds of branding opportunities here. Okay, get in touch. And as with regards to the future of the pod, I don't know. Don't ask me. How would I know? We'll see how it goes. Bye.